Pirates of the Caribbean. At World's End, I believe, is their little subtitle for number three here. And as I went and watched the movie the other day, the thing that I came away with is the same thing that I came away with Pirates of the Caribbean 1 and Pirates of the Caribbean 2. And that is, I leave there and I go, what did I just see? What was that all about? And as I've talked to friends of mine, they've said, I love all of the special effects, but I'm not really sure half the time what's going on. Half the time, I'm not quite sure if Jack Sparrow is a good guy or a bad guy. And even at the end of the film, I think he's a good guy. And then as I watch it, there's just so much going on that a lot of times I'm just going, what am I in the middle of watching? What is this all about? And after I left that movie, I thought, even though a lot of times I'm a little lost as to what's going on and who's doing what and are they good or bad, and at the end you're still not quite sure what happened, I think that movie is a little bit more like life than a lot of the other movies that are made. Like last week we talked about Spider-Man 3, and we know in the end there's no way Spider-Man can die, right? We know going in the movie, there's no way. But then when he's getting, clubbed to death, you're like, well, he might. But we know that that's not going to happen. The thing is, with Pirates of the Caribbean, there are no rules. I mean, anything can happen. Anybody, can essentially be written off of this thing. And as I watched the movie, and at the end of the movie, I reflected upon it, and I thought, that's probably a little bit more like life than anything. There are so many surprises, so many things that are going on, so many things that could happen, that it's a little bit more like life. In the fact that it doesn't just present this neat little ending that, at the end of most movies, especially the romantic comedies, they wind up getting married, right? I mean, that's where it ends. And you see the wedding day, you don't see the days after when they're, in fights and stuff like that, because we don't want to know about that. I mean, we want to see this nice wedding and it ends and, hey, that's the way I liked it, and we move on from there. But I think Pirates is a little bit more like my life, at least, in the fact that I never know what's going to happen next. It's not anything that I planned. Most of the days, sometimes I, like what we talked about last week, where Spider-Man dealt with his identity and he wanted to be a good guy, but at the same time had struggles with being a bad guy. And I think so many times that I'm more like that than I am anything. And so there's something about film, there's something about a story that we're drawn into. Like if I were to tell you facts about Jack Sparrow, you'd go, okay, that's really boring, If I were to say, hey, he's a pirate, and then, we're not drawn to facts. Some facts intrigue us, but for the most part, we don't want to go back to school and learn a bunch of facts, do we? We're drawn to story for some reason, and it's in the heart of every human being. We are drawn into story, and we like story. We don't necessarily like and are looking for a story in which nothing bad happens. Have you ever noticed that? What do they tell you that every good story has? It's going to have some tension. It's going to have some stressful moments. It's probably going to have some bad things that happen. And then we're looking for, how is this going to be redeemed? In other words, how is it going to be turned into a good thing? We would reject a story in which everything was great, nothing ever happened bad, there was no tension, no drama. We would say, that's boring, right? We want to see a story with some conflict, some interest, the good guy, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy? Let me ask you this question. What's the story of your life? Because you've got one. And I think that's why we're drawn to stories so much, is that we want to live a good story. We want the ending to end well. I want you to look with me at Matthew chapter 25. If you have those Bibles there in front of you, I think it's on page 847. I forgot to write it down on my notes this morning, but I think it was page 847. If I'm wrong, someone correct me on the correct number, okay? Page 847, Matthew chapter 25. We're going to start in verse 14. Let me explain to you what Jesus has been doing here. he's been explaining to people what the kingdom of heaven is like. And there's a lot of misconceptions that he knew about in his day, and he's trying to clear up some misconceptions. And so he goes through a series of stories, and this is one of them. I don't think that it's a mistake that Jesus taught using stories. So many times I think as pastors and preachers, we've kind of gotten into this didactic way of teaching. And in Greek thought, you know, that's kind of the way that things went, was everything was, you know, here's one, here's two, there's three, there's four, there's five, and boom, there's your life. Well, the problem is with that, that's not the way my life usually goes, you know. I'll experience one, but then I'll have to skip to step five because there were no steps two, three, and four. And if you're like me, we're more drawn to story because story relates to us versus 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And isn't it interesting that Jesus never taught that way? He never said, now, point number one of my sermon today is, and point number two is, and point number three is, and I've got a cute little poem that I'm going to stick at the end to make it sound good. And it's not to say that that way of teaching is wrong or that it's bad or whatever else, but Jesus never employed that. As a matter of fact, if Jesus were probably walking around today, he would probably be one of those storytellers that we might want to listen to. Maybe even someone who used comedy, and maybe someone who knew how to tell a story, or maybe someone who was in film, because he was great at telling a story. And that's how he taught. And you may look at it and say, well, that's kind of what his listeners were used to. They weren't. They kept looking at him and saying, when are you going to quit telling stories and just tell us what you mean? They got so frustrated with him, and he was like, no, the time's not right yet. And so he used these stories. So he's right in the middle of telling some stories, trying to correct their thought about the kingdom, because what they think is this, because Jesus is there, that the kingdom is starting right then. And he's explaining to them, no, it's not yet. So he says this. He says, again, the kingdom of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man going on a trip. He called together his servants and gave them money to invest for him while he was gone. He gave 5 bags of gold to one, 2 bags of gold to another, and 1 bag of gold to the last, dividing it in proportion to their abilities, and then left on his trip. The servant who received the 5 bags of gold began immediately to invest the money and soon doubled it. The servant with 2 bags of gold also went right to work and doubled the money. But the servant who received the 1 bag of gold dug a hole in the ground and hid the master's money for safekeeping. After a long time, their master returned from his trip and called them to give an account of how they'd used his money. The servant to whom he had entrusted the 5 bags of gold said, "Sir, you gave me 5 bags of gold to invest, and I've doubled the amount." The master was full of praise. "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in handling this small amount, so now I will give you many more responsibilities. Let's celebrate together." Incidentally, let me just pause there. If you've never thought about God throwing a party, you need to think about that. Several times in Jesus' parables, he would always come back to the fact that the Father threw a party, okay? So a lot of times I know we have this, you know, view of God as he's always serious and somber, and Jesus is saying that's not really the way it is, okay? So when Jesus is saying, let's celebrate together, he's saying this is what God's going to do. He's going to throw a party for this person, all right? Verse 22, next came the servant who had received the 2 bags of gold with the report. "Sir, you gave me 2 bags of gold to invest, and I have doubled the amount." The master said, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in handling this small amount, so now we'll give you many more responsibilities. Let's celebrate together." Then the servant with the 1 bag of gold came and said, "Sir, I know you are a hard man, harvesting crops you didn't plant and gathering crops you didn't cultivate. I was afraid I would lose your money, so I hid it in the earth, and here it is." But the master replied, "You wicked and lazy servant. You think I'm a hard man, do you, harvesting crops I didn't plant and gathering crops I didn't cultivate? Well, you should have at least put my money into the bank so I could have had some interest. Take the money from this servant and give it to the one with the 10 bags of gold. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who are unfaithful, even what little they have will be taken away. Now throw this useless servant into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And I don't know about you, but sometimes we get this concept of Jesus in our mind that he was always this ooey-gooey, lovey little guy that just loved everybody and never had a spat with anyone, and that's partially true and partially not true. And you notice there at the end that Jesus clearly says, this is what God's going to say to the person that has nothing to do with what he's about. He calls them, and this is, I mean, it's harsh for me because I'm like, wow, this is really tough stuff. He goes, you wicked and lazy servant. Man, that's a tough, tough thing from God. And you notice what he's saying is, you are around me a lot. In other words, you were a part of the Father's house, all right? You did a lot of things around here, but you never knew the Father's heart. See, I know people that have attended church all their life, and they think because they've attended church all their life, then that means that God's going to just say, oh, yes, you know, welcome, you know. And Jesus clearly says, and he's pointing this directly at a lot of the Pharisees. These were the religious rulers of the day, the people that knew everything about God, supposedly. And he's trying to say to them, you're around the Father's house, but you have no idea about the Father's heart. You have no clue. And I don't know what your story is, you know? All of us have one. And I don't know how you're doing and investing your talents. Literally hear what Jesus told the people was. God gave these people, okay, for each one of these bags of gold, basically bags of silver, each one of the bags represented 2.5 years worth of wages. It's a lot of money. This isn't, you know, $30,000. You know, this is over $100,000. In some cases, $500,000. In some cases, over $1 million. And God hands it to him and says, do with it what you will. You know what's so amazing to me? Is that God never looks at those people and say, well, you know what your problem was? You risked too much. Who did he get on to? He got on the one that wasn't interested in investing anything, just going to go hit it, hide it in the ground, and then do whatever they wanted to for the rest of their life, and then come back and say, here you go. I didn't do anything with it. You may say, well, is this about money? It's really not, but it is also about money. It's about our life. It's about who we are. This last week, on Friday, I decided to take a walk down to the downtown cemetery. Anybody gone to the downtown cemetery? Do you even know where the downtown cemetery is? Let's see here. Yes, it would be back this way, I believe. Right next to Jacob's Field, right across from Jacob's Field, there's a cemetery over there. Have you ever seen that? Driven by and went, I wonder who's in there. And then you thought, I don't think I'm going to go find out. Well, I decided I wanted to go find out. And so I took some photographs of some things that were over there. I know you're thinking, what is the pastor of Gateway doing in the cemetery? Well, a lot of the people down East 9th were wondering what I was doing. I'm sure taking photographs of grave sites and stuff. But the thing that I noticed is this. They all have similar things in common. There's always, you know, a birth date or a roundabout. You know, some of these go way back to the 1700s, so it was kind of like, you know, born in the year 1700. They didn't have a specific month and day, but they always had a death date, okay? And so I took a few pictures, and let's go ahead and show. This was one that I found interesting. Unknown early settlers, originally buried in Cleveland's First Cemetery, whose remains now rest in this lot. So there's people that were around Cleveland, lived in Cleveland, worked around Cleveland, farmers, I don't know, mercantile, whatever. But obviously their life didn't count for very much because no one stuck around to say, this is who lies here. This is who's buried here. And maybe the marker got moved or removed or whatever else, but we have no idea who these people are. Next one, go ahead and go to the next one. This is one that I kind of labeled as I saved it, depression and sadness, because when you look at the marker, I don't know if you can read it from where you are, but this is a listing of all of their children that had died. And when I read that marker, I was like, wow, now there's a story to tell. Can you imagine? The very first one at the top says John, aged 1 year, 2 months. Margaret, aged 3 years, 8 months. Mary, aged 7 years, 8 months. Joseph, aged 13 years. Mary Jane just aged 21 days. Margaret, aged 9 months. John, aged 9 months, 27 days. What do you think their story is? Pain. Hurt. You think they question God a little bit? I would be shocked to meet them one day and they say, oh no, everything was fine. I think there was a lot of hurt. I think there was a lot of pain. Wonder what their story is all about. Go ahead and go to the next one. These are the original people who helped settle Cleveland. If you know a little bit about the founding of Cleveland, Moses Cleveland is the founder, but he only stuck around like 2 or 3 months. Okay, I mean, he got the name, but he never came back. which I always kind of go, shouldn't the people that stayed, did it be named after them? But no, that's not the way that some things work sometimes. These were the Carters, it's the last name. And if you noticed right in the middle there, it said, when others fled, fever, and does anybody know what that next word is? Ague, have you ever seen that word? When I first saw that, I thought, is that a misspelling? What is that word? That was actually the fever that resulted from malaria. Okay, so that was what they were referring to, was malaria. The Carter stayed. And I thought, now there's a story. There's someone who stuck it out. Everybody else left, but they stayed. Go ahead and go to the next slide, because there's a marker at the top of their grave that says this: they remained, others fled. And I thought, you know, it's so unique. There's some markers that you can't find. There's unknowns. And then there's a few that are known. There's a few that went through certain heartache. And obviously these people did too, because other people said, hey, man, I've had enough. I'm not sticking around Cleveland. I'm getting out. People are dying left and right. This is hard. And what I love about it is that they stuck with it. They had the spirit that we're going to make it through it. Go ahead and go to the next one. I loved this quote at the bottom of this one. A pioneer whose day is done. I love the pioneering spirit, because these people were promised nothing. There was nothing here. And yet they made their way, some of them to the country from other countries, some coming from Massachusetts and Connecticut and things like that. And yet they came here and they were like, this is where I'm going to make it. This is where I'm going to make something happen. And you know, when I look at these people, I think, you know, this may be some of the people that Jesus was talking about. And I don't know what their relationship with God was like, but these are people that took something and made something. And some of them had nothing, and they made something out of it. And I love that line, a pioneer whose day is done, because the one thing that we all need to understand is that we're all born with a terminal condition. I know sometimes you'll hear, oh, they have terminal cancer, or so forth and so on. But, you know, we've all got an expiration date. If you hadn't figured that out yet, you're born with one. And I'm not here to scare you, or, you know, to make you think depressing thoughts and stuff like that. But the reality is we've all got a terminal illness, and it's called being human. And the one interesting thing about all of our markers, it's going to have two dates. All of our dates are probably going to be different, okay? And yours is going to say whatever year that you were born, whatever day, and whatever month. And then it's going to say whatever day, whatever month, whatever year. But the one thing that we all have in common is that middle dash. Let me ask you this morning, what are you doing with the dash? What's your story going to be? Are we going to be able to put on your marker like this lady, a pioneer whose day is done? I don't think that was an accident. I don't think that was the running slogan of the day. Maybe it was. I've never seen one before like that. Maybe you have, and then I would question you as to how many cemeteries you go to, which is a little weird. But I've never seen that one. When I saw that one, I was like, wow, now that's a great line. But let me ask you this question. According to what Jesus was saying there, is her pioneering days really over? Not according to what Jesus just told us. Because a lot of times what I think that we misunderstand is that we come to that and we go, oh, well, that's talking about here and now. Jesus meant it both ways. He meant it here and now, yes. He's going to reward and he's going to condemn based upon how we use our talents, how we use our time, how we use our resources. There's no doubt about it. But then there's also one day when we stand before God where this thing is going to happen where God's going to call us all to account. How did you use what I gave you? Not how did you use what I gave you compared to someone else. It's going to be, how did you use what I gave you? See, for some of you, you're not that talented. And you would stand up and say that, that's me, man. I just don't have a whole lot of stuff. You've got one bag of gold somewhere. You do. How do I know that? Because Jesus was clearly saying, everybody's got something. Some people are gifted with more. And some of you are saying, yeah, that's me, you know. And some of you women need to slap the man that's sitting next to you that thinks that he's all that because he's not, all right? And you're like, well, you know, yeah, I'm a 10 bag of gold kind of guy, you know. I'll tell you a story. When I was growing up, and you will say that there is no way, but I've got phone numbers I can give you at the very end. Go ahead and bring up the lights a little bit. Thanks, guys. Some of you will say there's absolutely no way, but I can give you phone numbers of people that will say this is the absolute truth. When I was in, coming out of grade school, junior high and stuff like that, I was attending a very large church, so much so that in 7th through 12th grade, we had 250 students that would regularly come to activities, okay? So this is a very large church. Not made to come. Now, I'm sure a few parents, you know, said you're going, but most of the time we wanted to be there because it was happening and we loved it. And so it's a huge youth group. Out of that youth group of 250, I can guarantee you, if I wasn't the most shy, I was right there at the top. I didn't talk a whole lot except to my close friends. I was not one that could get up in front of people. As a matter of fact, there is no way that I'd get up in front of people. That would freak me out. Now, I was involved with music and things like that, and so I could get up and, you know, play my violin or play piano or something like that, but if I had to get up and talk, and some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, if you have to get up and talk, oh, man, no way, you know, this would be terrible. And some of you, just thinking about it, your palms start sweating, you know, and you get a little bit nervous. Oh, my gosh, I got to get up and say something to people. And it's just not your thing. And I can honestly tell you, it certainly wasn't my thing. As a matter of fact, just getting up in front of I'll never forget an eighth grade science, man. We had to give a science report, and all I had to do was read this thing about dinosaurs, like three paragraphs. I got to the second paragraph and got like, I call it cotton mouth. I don't know what you call it, but you know when you get that stuff that builds up in the back, I'm not trying to be gross, but it's just factual. That stuff that builds up in the back of your mouth because you get really nervous, and then you go to try to swallow it, and it will not go down. And I got like gagged this thing, and I couldn't finish my report. I had to get someone else to read it for me, to finish it for me. That was eighth grade, man. I'll never forget that because it was a traumatic experience. And I got to that part, and I finally went, I can't talk. It was terrible. And everybody afterwards was like, what was wrong with you? I was like, I don't know, you know? I just fell apart. And it was so embarrassing and humiliating in front of all your peers. Well, I had felt like God was calling me into full-time ministry around that same time, and people were asking me, oh, so you're going to go into music, because that's what I was pretty good at. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think there's a good chance God may want me to be a pastor one day or something like that. No one ever said anything to me, but I know what was talked about. He'll figure it out. This isn't what he's called to do. It'll be all right. He can't even talk to three people, you know, at once. There's no way that this will happen. Well, around my 10th grade year, my mom approached me and she said, you know, moms, they have a habit of interrupting your life at the most inopportune moments. You know what I'm talking about? And so she comes to me with advice and says, hey, you know, if you're going to do this thing, then what you need to do is you need to join McClellan High School's debate team, because I hear that they have one of the best debate teams in the state. And of course, if you're deathly afraid of getting up in front of people, what would you do at this point? You're not going to join the debate club, right? I mean, that's the worst thing that you could possibly do, is to put yourself through that kind of horror. So I may be shy, but I'm not stupid. So I read in the curriculum from McClellan High School that it says, in order for you to take debate one, you have this thing called a prerequisite. Everybody know what a prerequisite is? Something that you have to take before you take that particular course. And it said, in order to be in debate, you must complete a year of speech. Are you tracking with me? Those of you who have evil minds, you know exactly what I'm going to do. Those of you who have saintly minds, you're like, what would you do? You are a good person. The rest of you are not. Okay, just so you know, I'm just kidding. And so here's what I did. I was like, okay, how am I going to get out of this? So I went back to my mom and I said, I tell you what, you're right about this. I probably do need to take debate. I'll make a deal with you. I'll take it my senior year. Now, if you're tracking, you know exactly what I'm doing. Well, here's what happened. We were sitting in English class. And remember when you would have to read those novels or stories all the way through and everybody took turns reading a part and it was the most boring thing in the world, you know, and everybody played a different part? Well, we were going through King Arthur in English. My teacher was a Cajun lady from Louisiana teaching us English, okay? So if you ever wonder where it all went wrong with me, now you know. Her name was Beverly Billingsley. Loved her to death. She couldn't ever say my first name correctly. She'd always call me Alex. She'd say, Alex, get over here. And still to this day, my friends that went with me to McClellan High School will say to me, do Miss Billingsley, because I do it exactly the way that she would say things. And she'd say, Alex, get over here and sit down. You know, and I, yes, Miss B, you know, and so I sat down. And she was handing out parts, and she said, Alex, you're going to read King Arthur. Okay. So we're reading through, you know, day after day after day. I mean, it seemed like it goes on for years, right, when you're reading through those things. And you know what happens the last day when you finally finish? Everybody slams it and then on the desk. You remember that? It was like this huge sigh of relief you were done. Miss B is sitting right next to me. I mean, right next to me. Her desk goes this way. Our chairs are kind of in rows like this around the room. I look over at her. She's in her 60s. She is crying. What do you do with your teacher when they're crying? And no one's yelled at them. And even if they have been yelled at, what do? You're in the 10th grade. What do you say? This is an adult. They're supposed to have it together. You don't want to yell, suck it up, you know, shake it off. You don't want to leave the room even when the bell rings because you're not quite sure what to do, and we were all frozen. I'm one of the closest ones to her, and I say, Miss B, are you okay? And she said, youngin, in all my years of English teaching, that's the best King Arthur I've ever had. And I said, well, ma'am, you've had some pretty terrible King Arthurs in your lifetime, and I just want to apologize on behalf of all of them. And she said, you're going to be in my debate class. And I said, no, I'm not. And she goes, oh, yes, you are. And I said, no, I'm not. She said, do you know how long I've taught here? And I said, well, a long time. She said, I opened the school. And she did. She did. I kid you not. She said, that guy down there with principal on his office, he don't run the place. I do. Yes, ma'am. We're well aware of that, but I'm not going to be in debate. And she said, you will be signed up for debate. I said, no, I won't. And she said, why aren't you going to be signed up? And I said, because I haven't taken speech one and speech two. She leaned over a desk and she goes, guess who wrote the prerequisite? You did? That's right. It came time for us to fill out what we were going to take. We actually had choices of what classes we could take. You know, you had your English and math and all the other stuff, but then you got like three or four classes you got to choose. So I go down to the counselor's office to get mine, and I get it, and I go to fill it out, and I'm like, what? On my form, debate one, authorized by Beverly Billingsley. She had gone to the counselor's office, pulled my card, signed me up, and turned it in. It was about 10 years before I told my mom what I had tried to do. Because, you know, it's kind of like when you've tried to line out smart your mom, you don't want to tell her tomorrow. You know, let 10 years go by and it's a funny story then, right? Okay? Use that. If go back and say, hey, you know that one night I told you I didn't really go do that. You know, it's funny then, okay? Not funny right now. There was no way I was going to tell my mom. I couldn't believe it. I was stunned. I went home freaking out. I'm going to be in debate. Man, I'm going to freak out. I'm going to get that cottonmouth thing. I'm going to get two sentences into it. And I'm going to be like, you know, I can't talk. God has a way of pulling out of you what you really have on the inside of you that you would deny that you do not have. And we were about halfway into that first year of debate, and there's other people in there, and I'm freaking out every single time that we had to do a debate. And some of the older ones, the seniors, are saying, hey, you guys are doing really good. And I'm just like, they're lying. You know, they've been told to say this, you know. The end of the year, state debate tournament, they're calling out all the names of, you know, third place, second place, you know, all this other stuff. And me and my debate partner are sitting there, and they call out, first place, Mike Hall and Alex Ennis. I was like, they have made a huge mistake, man. We're going to walk up there, and they're going to be like, we're sorry, you came in last. And I didn't realize, you know, see how I could make that mistake. You know, I'm so sorry. We were stunned. I walked up there to the front, and I kept on saying to Michael, they've made a mistake, man. They've made a mistake. So we get up there. We're not smiling. We're not high-fiving. We're not happy because we're in total shock. Michael went later on to get a degree in physics from Texas Christian University and stuff like that. I mean, we were not designed to do this sort of thing. And we get back the reports, and it was like, man, you were excellent, and this was perfect, and this is exactly what you're supposed to do, and this is... And we were shocked. We just kept on reading this stuff going, this isn't us, you know. This is someone else. They put our name on there wrong. This is not us. And I say that to you to let you know God has a way of taking what's inside of you and making it your strength. Now, there's things that I've found out in my life that are not my strength. I've tried it several times, different ways, and I just realized, okay, God has not gifted me in this area, and that's okay. But then there's other things that God's given me that I didn't even know was on the inside of me. And you're never going to know until you risk. See, there's one thing about investing that you always need to learn. There is no risk-free investment. Ever. There isn't. You've got to learn to be a risk taker. And if you don't learn how to be a risk taker, you're not going to be one that's going to enjoy seeing God one day, because he's going to look at you and say, why didn't you get out there and use what I gave you? Because I would have given you more. You know, a lot of people have the idea that when we get to heaven one day that we're just going to sit around playing harps. I don't know where that came from, because that is totally not biblical. Okay? Now, if you want to play a harp, you can play a harp. I'm not going to play one. Okay? I have no desire to play a harp. But if you've always wanted to play a harp, have at it. But you know what God's going to do? He's going to set things up basically the way it was in the garden, where when you tried to do something, it always worked out. Because Jesus is pointing out there are rewards here on earth, but ultimately you want the rewards to be in heaven, because that's what's going to last eternally. And some of you may be sitting here thinking, man, I've tried a lot of things, and a lot of times I get passed over for promotions, and I do as good a work or better work than anybody else. I get passed over. What's the deal? How come it doesn't work out? For some of you, you may be sitting in this room saying, well, I'm kind of older now, and I haven't really used what God's given me, and I should have, and I should have given more here, and I should have. And you know something? It's never too late to start. It's never too late. As long as you've got breath. Now, if one of these days we have to put the hyphen on the tombstone, okay, now then it's too late. But every one of you is going to have a dash. And only the people that know you and know about you are going to be able to tell other people what that dash is all about. That's it. And God then is going to look at you and say, okay, this is the things that I gave you. How did it come out? And he's not going to say, well, you're not as good as Ben over here. You should have done like Ben. It's not a comparison with other people. It's a comparison with what he gave you. It's like the missionary that came back from China. He had served for 30 years. It was back in the 1800s, and he came home, and he had sent telegrams ahead to say, hey, I'm coming back. You know, could you meet me at the shipyard and pick me up? And he had his luggage with him. He showed back up. There was a band playing. There was a parade going on, and he got really excited. And he thought, wow, man, my friends have really gone all out. And then when he started reading the banners pretty closely, he realized he was on board with one of the leading politicians in Great Britain at the time. The band was for the politician, and the crowd was for the politician. He thought, well, surely in all this mass of people, you know, my relatives, my friends are here. He walks down. He sits on his luggage for several hours. The crowd disperses, and there's absolutely no one there to greet him. 30 years living in China, giving his life to try to present the gospel to people. No one's there. And finally, he gets mad after a couple hours, and he goes, God, I didn't need a band. I didn't need a crowd. But couldn't you have sent somebody to welcome me? And it was at that point in time that he is confident that at least one point in time in his life that God's voice was maybe not audible, but as clear as it had ever heard in his ears and in his mind. And God simply responded back, you're not home yet. You're not home yet. What I want to encourage you and challenge you to do, and this is what I have to challenge myself to do so many times, is that even if everything you try in this life does not work out, you're not home yet, your reward doesn't need to be here on earth. Your reward needs to be eternally, because when you think about an investment, I don't know about you, but a 60 or 70 year investment compared to eternity is a pretty big deal, and it's a pretty big difference. And the encouragement and challenge that I want to give to you is this. Even if in your lifetime, if every single thing that you try, if you always get passed over promotions, it never works out the way that you want it to, you work not for the person that you're under or the company that you work for, you work for God, because ultimately, He will make sure that your reward is secure. Are there rewards here on this earth? Absolutely. Will Christ send you some? Possibly. But I don't know about you. I'd rather have something for eternity rather than just for a few short years. Now, does that mean that, oh, you earn your way to heaven, you work your way to heaven? No, that's not what Jesus is pointing out here. What he's trying to explain to them is this. You need to understand the Father's heart, not just be in the Father's house. You need to understand that your life needs to be more defined by what you're giving and by the attitude of your heart and who you are and what God's given you, which may be one talent or 10 talents or 10,000 talents. But ultimately, all of us are going to have a dash. And I loved what I read about some of these people. While others fled, they stayed. There's a story to tell. There's something that lasts. There was heartache involved. There was pain. But yet they stuck with it. And for the rest of you that say, well, you know, I hadn't really been that close to God, and man, I've kind of wasted a lot of things, put that behind you, because what matters is from this day forward. That's what matters. Until the day that you draw your last breath. But if you're still breathing, you've still got plenty of chances to reinvest in what God wants you to do. Say, well, oh, is this a message now then where you're going to turn it about what we need to give to Gateway? No. No, because life is about a whole lot more than that. It's about who we are as a person. It's about what we're defined by is more than what we own, what we do. It's who we are. It's where our heart is. And that's what Jesus is trying to get to. It's not how much that you have, it's what you do with it. Where's your investment? When you look back upon your life, what's your investment really all about? God may bless you with amazing material things. Nothing wrong with that. Jesus never said there was a problem with that. He said, but if those things own you, that's where the problem is. That's where the problem is. I want everyone just to bow their heads and close their eyes. I'm not sure where you're coming from this morning. I'm sure we've all had our struggles. We've all experienced loss, heartache, hurt. There's some of you in this room that have probably experienced a great life, and you're to be commended for living that great life. And there's others of you that said, man, it just seems like everything I've tried, it just never did turn out. And so this morning, I want you just to kind of focus in on what God would speak to your heart about this morning. This Wednesday evening, we're going to be over at Westside Ecumenical, basically throwing a party for inner city kids that their parents earn about $8,000 to $12,000 a year, and that is it. And we're going to give them free cotton candy and free snow cones, hot dogs, bounce houses. There's no charge. We're not there to push Gateway Church. They'll know who we are, but that's not the point. The point is to give them something that they would and otherwise not receive. And I want to challenge you that maybe that's something that you can go and do. Maybe you can meet us out there and give a little kid a great time that normally doesn't get that. Maybe it's that you begin to serve somewhere where you give back. Maybe that's here at Gateway or through Gateway, or maybe you come up with a ministry that we can tag team with you on and bring others in. And I just want you to, in the stillness of this moment, just to find out, what is God speaking to your heart about? Because this passage really isn't about money. It's really about our life. It's really about that dash in the middle. What are we going to say about that dash? What's God going to say about that dash? What are you risking for God? What are you investing for God? Lord, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for a chance to reflect upon your word. And Lord, so many times in my life, I just get lazy. I just get apathetic, and sometimes I just really don't care. And things that should bother me just don't. The things that shouldn't matter do. And I just walk away sometimes and think so highly of myself, and then when I really reflect, I've just been pathetic. I've just done everything that makes me happy, and I could care less if it doesn't make anyone else happy. And so, Father, help us to be servants. Help us to take either what little that we've been given or how much that we've been given and use for your kingdom. So that, Father, we can hear you say one day to us, well done, good and faithful servant. Let's celebrate together. Father, we want to be obedient. Help us to be obedient. In Jesus' name.